call this meeting workshop to order for February 10th. And first on the agenda, I guess it's you, Commissioner Tucker. We're going to talk about the breakwater and looking at some impacts on what we're talking about in terms of the breakwater repair.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, as we know, we have to rebuild the breakwater. And as we remember, yeah, we all remember in this group, we had a group from Tacoma come up and tell us about the habitat, and I'd never seen it, didn't know much about it. And so in the meantime, we've been trying to figure out how we can retain that habitat. That habitat's a pretty important habitat. Where, as a fisherman, I run up against a lot of ESA listings and a lot of problems, and habitat seems to be the basis for almost all of them. And here's a chance where, a place where we're going to be removing habitat, taking away all these rocks that have been down at the base of this jetty for like 85 years and has got just teeming with life, replacing it with a sheet pile that doesn't have any place for life to live. I mean, we're admittedly taking away the creosote, but we're putting back nothing. And so it was my idea, pretty naive, I guess, to think, well, let's just move the rocks over and put the sheet pile in there. Well, I hadn't really been on the Jim and Larry end of permitting much, so I discovered that ended up being a big problem. So I've enlisted, I brought it up to the MRC, where NAM is, and I've also brought it up to dive community, and to see if we could get some assistance on being able to retain the habitat there. And there's a couple of reasons besides just fish. One reason is that hauling everything out and disposing of it at a dredge spoil site is going to cost us a bunch of money. And if we were to be able to just leave the rocks there, we'd be killing two birds with one stone, saving a bunch of money and leaving habitat. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Nam and Don to talk about the ramifications.
Hi, everybody. My name's Nam Sue. I'm a local marine biologist, but I'm here to represent the diving community as well as the marine science and naturalism communities. I'm a very active diver. Pump Hudson there is absolutely my favorite site, not only because it's so accessible. I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people come here to dive. They don't have to haul their gear up and down, you know, steps and whatnot. It's just right there. And what I was really hoping to present to you all today is, you know, take you all on a little underwater tour by showing you pictures and videos from that site. But unfortunately, my computer's not cooperating with me, and even if I could get it up, I guess I'm going to not be able to get it on the screens to share with everybody. So I find this kind of fell through. But I guess I'll share with you a little bit what I know is down there. And it's not just the jetty itself, that entire area of the Maritime Center. You know, a lot of us divers consider that itself a park because, you know, you can start to dive under the Maritime Center dock. There's a lot of structure. There's a lot of cool things to see. You can get down to about 50 feet of depth right at the end of their float there. If you head east, you can eventually make it to the dolphin piles, the submarine nets there. That's something us divers call the eagle, because if you're down there and you look up, it's just absolutely amazing. It's covered in white, giant, plumeless anemones, often teeming with fish. Actually, I dove this site last Wednesday, and that was the first time I've ever seen a wolf eel. There was a wolf eel nestled up inside one of those wooden piles. But obviously, this is not the area of focus. The area of focus is the jetty itself. And if you follow that jetty from shore down, the rock riffraff there starts at about 12 to 20 feet in depth, and it goes all the way down, way beyond the jetty. You know, I believe you all might have seen the bathymetry survey that the engineers did for that site. You'll see that those rock riffraff actually go down to about 67 feet, and on the bottom there, that they're actually, I think it's an old frame of a barge. And that creates a lot of habitat. There's actually a lot of kelp on the upper extents of that rock riffraff reef.
You can use the picture right back to you if you just want to point to some of the.
So basically, at this crook right here is when we're on a rock start. And again, I from my understanding of this project is that, you know, it's good to remove all of those creosote piles, which, you know, unfortunately, a lot of fish actually like to be in those piles. I myself, when I'm down there, you can actually crawl into those piles about 5-10 feet. needs to be replaced because they're absolutely rotted out. It looks like they're hollow, and it's great for fish. Unfortunately, that's going to go, and as you can imagine, replacing that with sheet piles, that's reducing the amount of complexity or just structure in the habitat for nooks and crannies for things to hide in. So, you know, from my experience as a marine biologist, I know that if we can at least retain some of those rocks are not toxic, they're not leaching any crews, so that will help to retain a lot of the reef. And I think in a pretty recent conversation Steve and I had, we realized that for the most part, to do the replacement, most of that rock is going to be undisturbed because it's lower and further out than where the piles are. And I think after we started, I'd like to try to show, you know, at least the commission, some of these pictures, if I could just sit in the middle. I'm sorry, audience, you guys will have to see it next time. But I really just want to share with you all just why this is so special, such a special site. And
why don't you put it on the corner by that Port Attorney sign there, Nam? Right in front of you. Right here. Yeah, and then just shine it back at us.
Okay.
So while you're doing that, I've got a question. You said the rocks are down and below the pilings. Are you saying they are outside of the piling wall?
Yes. Yes.
So that's the rocks that are running out?
Right. No, when that was built, the rocks were all the way to the very top.
Right.
And over the years, as the piles have eroded, broken, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the other problem that the engineer found is they used the Matsmats quarry rock, which is actually very soft volcanic rock.
So it's breaking up.
Right, the wave action over the decades, you know, beating the rocks next to each other, it's like hitting with a sledgehammer, and they get into smaller pieces and tumble out. Yeah.
Could I flip some of the lights off?
Sure.
I think these so one thing I do want to mention is, amongst all those rocks, there are a lot of kelp, and that kelp, again, itself creates a lot of habitat for the fish. I don't know if you all can see this, but this is at the bottom. It's pretty sandy for that first part before that crook there. It's all sandy, so you know, I'm not really concerned about that. There are no rocks to be removed and whatnot. But my concern is that in order to pull a lot of these rotted wooden piezo piles out, you know, they're probably going to break off, and then they're going to have to excavate and get some of the, you know, remove some of the rocks to get the stubs out. And in order to drive the sheet piles, I can't imagine they can drive any sheet piles unless they get rid of the rocks. They won't be able to drive through the rocks. So this is at the bottom, right before the crook there. You see it's sandy, and you know there are a lot of spaces that you can actually, you know, I can get into there and look straight up. There will be a few pictures showing that. But you see it's covered with anemones and kelp. Just more pictures of the site, just showing the amount of life that has grown on there. Again, I'm not so concerned about the piles because they have to go. They're toxic, they're leaching. But as you can see, once you start getting lower, you start getting some rocks, you have the piles, and this is a big school of surf perch, which, you know, I can imagine would be of tremendous interest to fishermen. I often see when I'm diving down there a fishing line, and sometimes people's rods in the water there, try to recover as much as I can. But I myself, once this is fixed, I know there's you can't walk out there anymore right now because of the condition it is, but I can't wait till it's fixed so I can go out and fish myself. But I've seen lingcods down there. I've actually seen a pretty decent sized lingcod. Last Wednesday I saw a greenling or two. But what's really interesting and what's really great about this site is not the big fish. They're all the small, really beautiful fish, such as grunt sculpins or mossy-headed wobbinets. Just really tiny fish that lives inside a dead barnacle shell, one of those big giant barnacle shells. So if we keep going, you see, looking at the piles, it has all those piles have developed a lot of life, and I'm really hoping that in the long run, those sheet piles would also retain this life. But you know, another good reason to retain a lot of those rocks is those rocks will be a source of seed per se. You know, a lot of the life that gets pulled out on the piles are gone, but those rocks can be retained as a source to replenish all the new sheet piles, the new materials, with more life. There is another fish over there, absolutely beautiful macroalgae out there. I mean, for my work, I dive throughout the Puget Sound and I survey throughout the Puget Sound, and this is one of the most diverse sites as far as macroalgae. I mean, I go out and collect myself to do press. It's really nice. And so on that note, I just want to mention that, you know, why I feel like I can come up here and talk to you guys about all this is that I've dove in the Puget Sound for the last 5 years
professionally as a scientific diver, surveying everywhere from Olympia all the way up to the San Juan Islands. I actually just did a survey up in Orcas, all the way up to Nia Bay on the Strait. So I've seen a lot of the underwater habitats in Puget Sound, and this by far is one of the best, and that's not just my opinion, it's shared by a lot of the local dive community. And again, in a second here, our local dive shop owner, Don, will come up and just talk a little bit about just the community and the economic impact that this has and the amount of visitors that come just to see the site. But really, I want to focus on the habitat and the life here. Again, looking up at the pilings, you see a lot of fish. There usually are a lot of rockfish there as well during the summer season. A lot of small Puget Sound rockfish, those are very important. I've seen China rockfish down there, blue and black rockfish, not as important. And every so often, I think I spot one of those brochios or yellow-eyed canaries, which you can imagine, those just got ESA listed as endangered species. So another reason why it would be really important to retain this, and when it comes to making this argument to the regulators that is giving the permit, I think that's one strong point to say, hey, you know, we're trying to conserve habitat that's already established for endangered species here. So again, looking up through the piles, just absolutely chock full of life, looking up again through the piles. And this is where, this is the bottom of that crook there, and you see this is where all the rocks start. And for the most part, again, a lot of these rocks have sloughed off and are pretty far away. You know, I just like to see that any rocks that get moved out get put back in its place. I know there were a lot of pushback from the regulators when we discussed the possibility of putting those rocks adjacent to create an artificial reef. And I can see why they got up in arms about that. Just because that's creating new footprint. You know, when you think about projects, a lot of the things the regulators look at are just how much footprint is being impacted. And I understand this project is being done under a nationwide permit 3-4 repair and reconstruction. And so it needs to stay in the exact same footprint. And so because of that,
or less, exactly.
Because of that, I totally, you know, think it's not feasible to try to put it adjacent, because that's just gonna be a nightmare, a permitting nightmare. But what I think could be done under the current nationwide permit is that any rocks that get taken out, like Steve says, we just put it right back in the same exact footprint. Now there's sheet piles out there. So, you know, I imagine the sheet piles are there and we can just put rocks at the base of it. And that in itself, you can imagine, would create a lot of nooks and crannies and just enough. And especially if it's the rocks from this area, it has a lot of that life already on there. And most of that would survive getting picked up by crane and whatnot. So more rocks. And you see, and what I want to show is that these rocks are just absolutely covered in kelp. It's not just bare rock we're talking about. This is rock or kelp, and these kelps are in layers. And oftentimes when you go in and you move the kelp, you just have fish, shrimp, crabs just scattered all over. So, I mean, this is a nursery habitat for a lot of organisms. Just more, show more kelp of the rocks.
How does this dock compare with Port Warden in terms of growth?
This site actually, because of the rock riprap here, it has a lot more growth in terms of kelp. That rock provides a hard substrate for the kelp to attach to with the holdfast and their systems. Whereas at Fort Warden, you know, I've dove the Marine Science Center and whatnot, there's a lot of sand there. So the only thing that's grown up there is a huge eelgrass bed, which in itself is very important. But
you have a lot more diversified ecosystem because you have different zones that can thrive that
in here.
On each area. So you have a depth range and you have a current there that's unique for that particular site that makes it very enriched with
the. So like the breakwater here at Boathaven wouldn't have the growth that we see here because there's not as much current.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's because it's at that point there. But what's great, you know, so stepping back on the marine science side of it, at Fort Warden, I imagine right at Point Wilson there, all those rock riprap, I'm sure it's teeming with life, but that is absolutely a horrendously dangerous spot for anybody to dive. I've heard really bad stories about people getting hurt or dying up there kayaking because of the currents. This is a really safe spot, and for the most part, it could be dove on most tide exchanges just because it's really protected because of the jetty and the Maritime Center dock, and you can really hug the rocks there. I mean, I've been up there in high current, and I just hug the rocks. That said, you know, as far as what Don was saying about the different levels of habitat, if you go down in water depth, as you can imagine, you have different types of kelp and algae. that's, you have the greens first and then you have the reds and the browns, and their color actually corresponds to the photoactive pigments they have and how they can access water light at different depths because light filters out. But so yeah, when you go in, it's absolutely beautiful. You go in through the green algae and you go in through the reds, and then at the bottom you have the browns, the bigger kelps. So it's very stratified, whereas you know, you can imagine that Fort Worth, it's just all eelgrass, which is, again, still very, very important. This is a barge structure, the barge structure that I was talking about at the very end of the jetty there. It's not, you know, it's out of the way. It's not going to be impacted as a result of this project, but I just want to share this because you can, you know, there are these ribs that stick up in a wall. It's almost like a container box, it looks like. And that's where I saw a pretty darn big incog.
So we got to kind of move it along a little bit here.
Yep. So what I just want to show is focus on rockfish. These are all pictures of rockfish that are taken at this site. As you can imagine, they're of tremendous significance both on a conservational level and on a recreational fishing level. The blue and blacks, I know you can fish, although the season here is relatively short. Other rockfish over there, blurry picture of rockfish. And so that's really all I have to show. And so I think I'm going to just put on a video in the background to a dive video of that site while Don comes up and talks a little bit about the economics or the tourism side of this picture.
Okay.
Performance?
Yeah.
All right.
Most.
Thank you. I'm Don Peterson, and I'm the owner of Octopus Gardens Diving. That everybody's probably seen right here, just most recently, just down the road. Thank you. I started diving, and real quick note on myself, I started diving in 1973 in the Northwest. And so I grew up in the area, and I'm pretty familiar with this region, and on the Seattle side, the Edmonds area. It wasn't 1991 as I started Octopus Gardens diving on that side of the pond as education, travel, and tourism. And I'm still connected with a lot of dive facilities for many years, and it wasn't until about 4 years ago, I opened up a brick and mortar store here in Port Townsend. My background, I've been involved in the commercial side of the industry as well as the environmental science. I'm still involved with that, currently now kind of subcontracting to various companies, still like what's going on at Bangor Bay. So I'm pretty familiar with what goes on in a construction project like that. And I'm just still heavily involved in that area. My strengths in terms of just being Octopus Gardens here in Port Townsend is I brought Dive Tech Incorporated is a service side of the industry. So I have 35 to 45 stores that ship me stuff, product, that I service on a regular basis. So I've watched stores come and go out of Port Townsend for 30 years. And when I opened up here, I brought in Octopus Gardens, educating, you know, that was a better name of a store. So I've had that name since 1991, and voila, Octopus Gardens it is. And the focus is on education and travel and tourism. In the diving community, I go from one end of Puget Sound to the other. I'm a captain for some companies, and I still do today. The diving community abroad, if you're a diver and you enjoy getting around the Puget Sound region, there's a lot of great sites accessible from shore. We're pretty spoiled as a diving community. If you come to Port Townsend, the place to go is Point Hudson. There's a lot of other dive sites and dives that you know enjoy, like you know Fort Fire Warden and other sites that are not really well named. But Point Hudson is the bucket list. And to lose that site, if for any reason that there's a construction project that does take it down, and it would be an economic disaster. The first year I opened up, you know, my emphasis was focusing on just bringing people to Port Townsend because it has a lot to offer as a package. You know, I mean, because we got a lot of things going on. We got events, we got festivals, and the divers that come to Port Townsend, they just don't go come and dive and just walk out. You already know what I'm going to say, things like they're going to use the hotels and restaurants. They actually will come in and do not just diving, but then other sports and activities because it's about kayaking, hiking, whale watching, and other events. And when my wife and I ran our first year, we did shop dives specifically to Port Townsend. Port Hudson. We had over 200 people signed waivers, so that's a fact. And then a lot of them will come up here on a regular basis and stay the weekend and enjoy what we have to offer here. Washington Scuba Lines, you know, when you pull specific math into it, you know, as far as tourism dollars, This report, as of 2013-2015, the legislature, this is the first comprehensive report Washington State did, and it's divided out into county, into Jefferson County, and that's the first time that they actually put scuba diving into it. I kind of like, I think it's narrow-minded looking at it and saying, you know, scuba divers, you know, the line going like this in the economics, you got to look a little bit more with the blinders off, because it has a lot more that they're doing when they come into town. And I know that is a fact, because when I ran travel part of it, we were specifically focused not just on divers to come to Port Townsend, but to do other things. Because if you do that, you're not going to make, we watched the stores come and close out of here. You know, so you have to bring other things to the table in tourism. And so this, you can pass it on, I don't have a whole bunch of them, but and I just highlighted the areas. They have a full report, it's 116 pages. That I cut right to the chase, to the simple math of it, what it has to offer. But if you're interested, that is a really good report and kind of shows you what can be done. Like I said, you know, Nam brought up some great points of what, you know, Point Hudson has to offer the diving community. All I can say is, you know, I do know from the history of this area, we all knew who Cousteau was. I was fortunate, I worked on the film team with his son. When he came to Seattle in 1969, he consulted with a gentleman, Gary Keffler, on the Seattle side, and he took him out to find the Pacific Giant Octopus. He brought him here to Port Townsend, Point Hudson. It was pretty cool. All right.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you all for giving your attention. And so, yeah, I just want to reemphasize that. Again, I know we spoke of being props to the side, and I think that's out of the question, but I think it's a pretty low-hanging fruit to just ask to put the rocks right back at the bottom of the sheet pile. So I think that's very cute. So, thanks again.
You know, Don, just to add to that, so I bought ComC Charters from Floyd in 1985, and that was a dive. We ran a dive. That was how I got started, was doing that. So the first dive you would do is all you had to do is undock and literally drift over to the breakwater and drop them in. So even back then, it was a remarkable dive. So,
yeah. I mean, divers, they don't look at it as just a dive site. They look at it as like a park. You know, if you're familiar with diving, then you know Edmonds Underwater Park.
Yeah.
And Edmonds Underwater Park and Bruce Higgins that worked at Patel, I worked with him for many years. And the city of Edmonds, they had 25, and you can Google this, but 25,000 divers more go to that area because of the artificial reef that it brings in. And that's how many people have come there to enjoy it. I know that this area is sitting on a unique opportunity, you know, if there's the network of tourism and somebody that will be open on a regular basis to appearing.
Well, and also, I know as a dive boat operator, it was a hard dive because it was the best dive of the area.
Yeah.
And so if you did that first out of the chute,
you kind of
gave them your best eggs out of the, yeah, so you had to kind of go over to the net on the other side or something and dive. And then
the keystone and steroids.
Right.
It's cool.
Yeah.
So my purpose in having this morning was because there's interest, the MRC isn't really represented here, although Nam and I are both on it, but the entire MRC is interested in this project. And where it was initially thought of as becoming an additional project based on some letters we got back from our person, I think that having people like Nam look at it, if we were just, you know, we'll keep it within the permit parameters of rebuilding our existing one, we can just ask the people, say, look, we just want to put the rocks that are there back where they are, and I think that should be a doable thing. But what I was looking for was buy-in from everyone here to go forward with that, and that would just require some meetings, perhaps, with WDFW and other people that are involved in saying yay or nay, and we could solicit some support from the dive community, from the MRC, and from people to go there, and that's what these people listen to. So. Basically, it's just, you know, we still have some time to go, but it would be useful to, you know, forget the big dive parts right now, but just retain what we have. Then if that gets retained, then perhaps in the future we could do something like Edmonds, but that would be a whole separate thing. We just want to keep this simple but not lose what we have now in the rebuilding aspect.
But I think for us today, like we were talking yesterday, I mean, we need to decide, we don't want to jeopardize the permit.
Right.
And
you gotta
and that's the decision.
The main goal here is to replace the breakwater. Otherwise, there's no wooden boat festival and everything else.
Right, and so I think the thing that needs to be addressed, and for you guys too, is, you know, are we willing to push, no pun intended, the rock up the hill a little bit to see what leniency there would be in terms of the engineering parameters of the sheet pile, the way it is? Like, could we actually put rock there? What would the engineer say to that?
Yeah, until we ask the question, we have a new person at the Corps of Engineers running our permit, and it's really slowed down. Mm. You know, whenever you get a new person at the desk, suddenly they want to go back to square one. And it looks like now, as of yesterday, we've got to do a full BA, biological assessment. And that's probably going to be about a $10,000 change order to run that through. And
what's a biological assessment?
Whenever you do a project, it varies. You know, the agencies, primarily the Corps in this case, they have different levels. And now I'm seeing a lot of this. You know, if a lot of other projects have happened in the same area, you know, they'll kind of accept the previous where biologists have gone in and said, okay, here's a species count, numbers, types, upland, you know, around project site. But this guy wants a whole new one for the site. So, you know, we'll have to do that. We can ask the question, you know, part of the engineering, if you remember, especially that first part coming out from the land to that bend, the new one, we're actually going to incorporate a lot of the existing rock in that. And then the sheet pile is just that last wing wall. And how much they'll allow us to replace the rock and that sort of thing, we'll just have to ask the question and respond to, you know, their issues and questions. And keep in mind, even though a sheet pile, it's not going to be a sterile environment. You know, stuff grows on steel too. You know, there'll be a lot of algae and anemones and all that growing on that. You know, it'll take a season or two for all the, you know, over time we'll get better and better, but it won't be a total sterile environment.
Martin?
I'm hearing that there's some solutions maybe outside the box. I know this isn't my department, I dive too, but the what about approaching the street the sheet pile as a solution as to actually creating some kind of texture on it? You bolt on cable nets, the dive community volunteers, you know, you weld on brackets, you weld on, you know, once that sheet pile being driven, the outside surface is relatively unimportant to the construction of the work. So instead of increasing your footprint, you look at the sheet pile as a medium for hanging cable nets, just like the old submarine nets that you dive on. And you try and create, come up with some creative solutions. How can we make texture to this sheet pile instead of worrying so much about the footprint? Is it going to be easier to push through? Can we get that done affordably, keep everybody happy? It's just an idea, but there's lots of things you could do to build texture to the front of that sheet pile. And I don't know, just an idea out there.
I worked on the tunnel project in Seattle and did a lot of surveys for environmental firm. And what was interesting, I didn't bring that up, but there was a lot of areas that Martin Krauser and Anchor Environmental, when I worked with them, the contractors, they had put in some structure on the outside of various parts of the seawall when we were doing the surveys and the bioassays. And within a couple of seasons, it was pretty impressive. You know, doing the video work for the company, there's a lot. It actually, in 2 seasons, it had substantial growth.
Yeah.
So I just want to mention real quickly that this biological assessment, I'm just kind of really surprised that you're requesting this now to us and this new guy, because you guys were supposed to get this under a nationwide permit for you, which doesn't require that. But this
not biological, a nationwide.
No, not a DW.
dredge spoils aren't going to allow it.
Okay.
So we're going for an individual.
Well, that is a lot more. And I regularly write biological assessments for my daytime job. What that basically is a take analysis of the ESA species. You know, somebody, a biologist comes in and looks at all the ESA species said this point, the fact that they're requesting a BA now, that is a structure in terms of mitigation and whatnot. Because if they're considering this an individual permit and if they're considering any of it new or whatnot, a lot of times they're going to want some kind of mitigation, and there's no easier or lower hanging fruit than just putting this stuff back there and retaining it. So I think it's important that when a BA gets created, that you know what we said today about habitat, the fact that there's rockfish there, is emphasized in the fact that you know if we do some of these conservation measures, we'll help retain that. If anything else, in my experience, make it go quicker.
So then, what about the permit? I mean, our main action has been, we don't want to slow the permit process down. We're kind of on a fast track with it. Does it change that?
It will be in permitting for most of this year.
Yeah.
Just keep in mind, there's two things. If you remember back to when Shane made his presentation, he made a good point. You can't drive sheet pile through rock, so we have to remove that. In order to remove that, we need to move the sheet pile all the way toward the Maritime Center, which is basically our lot line with DNR. So we can't put rock on the Maritime Center side because we don't have a PMA that would allow us to do that. We have to
create
a new port management agreement. We also, as part of this project, wanted to widen the channel to 84 feet. We can't put rock on the inside or we're going to narrow that channel down. So we've got two competing interests. We're basically building a structure on our lot line, and we want to keep the interior of that sheet pile as wide as we can. So those are the two things that are competing. So there's a lot more to it than just talking to the regulators and letting us put rock out there.
But a PMA could be agreed on.
All of this
fairly,
is doable, but yes. You know, this could be another year. We're adding to the
all our PMAs were just renewed last September for another 10 years. And it's not that easy. They'll process, go back to DNR and expand the PMA. Because you're essentially taking over state tidelands from the state.
It's all doable, but it's not going to be easy.
So the existing PMA goes what, to the outside of the...
Right on the edge of the breakwater.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to move the sheet pile
to that
the outside edge.
And you would want it, you wouldn't want to put the rock on the inside anyway, because there's no water flow in there, so it's like...
Yeah, you can't be diving on the inside.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're going to be chewing you up if you are.
There is a little safety issue there when you get somebody steaming around there, but... Yeah, we'll ask all these questions, you know.
Yeah.
The only other concern I think I've articulated to a couple of you yesterday is that if we get to a point where we really want to do this and it's additional cost above and beyond the just the replacement, you know, we don't know what those costs are going to be yet, if they are. You know, it will be a commission decision if you want to cover that or if somebody else is going to step up and get a grant or, you know, that sort of thing.
And Don, you illustrated, I mean, there's an economic advantage to this too. So, you know, we have to weigh an additional cost with what it is that we're talking about
in terms
of the dive industry.
We're the ones that are going to have to pay for it. And every time we pay for something that's not in the budget, that puts more pressure on moorage rates and yard rates and
kayak rates
and every other, you know, just. I just want all of us to, you know, this is just one project, part of a bigger.
I guess part of the issue would be that, you know, the contractor finds during the initial removal and the would be, I don't know if there's an identifier to differentiate between creating a problem driving the new material in. I mean, obviously, you're not going to know that until it occurs, but in some cases, I do know from other projects that I've been involved with. During the removal, you know that it's going to have little, very little impact.
And a lot of this, wouldn't be knowing that, as you would know,
is
that BA will also kind of dictate how we drive the sheet piling, whether it's a vibrator or a hammer or, you know.
Vibration system moves a lot.
Right, so and that will impact, you know, whether we need to move rock or how far and all that stuff too. So there's a lot of unknowns out there. Early stage, so.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say one last thing. In terms of permitting, I definitely understand the importance that, like, you know, the goal here is to replace that breakwater and the infrastructure for the port. You know, if we can conserve anything on the side, that's just icing on the cake. In terms of not slowing down permitting, I think what's really important are a lot of informal conversations to be had, because if any of this is annually, then it gives them 30 days to respond. And you have 30 days to respond. But what really, a quick way to bypass that is to pick up the phone and talk to the project manager and call and say, hey, this is an informal conversation. They're thinking about X, Y, and Z ideas. If we present this formally, would you say yes or no? And they won't tell you, but they'll say this is favorable or non-favorable. And that could get rid of a few months where it will.
What I actually foresee is probably physically going over to Seattle for the core office. We've done that before in projects. And we sit down with them. And sometimes, you know, that face-to-face, get to know the individual and, you know, build a little more trust. And it's not, we're just not just another project in his inbox that he's got to wrestle with. So
I'd just like to offer, as an MLC member, I'm happy for you to continue about providing advice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would encourage you guys to stay pretty close to this as far as keep calling and coming.
More to follow.
We good? You guys good?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to next item is the work float, and it's just one of a couple of items. The shipyard, we're going gangbusters in the shipyard, and we've got a new tenant down there with Corey Armstrong, and I talked with him the other day, and he's going great guns. And so there is more pressure on resources down there, particularly with the work float. And so Shipwrights Co-op, and I think it's just Shipwrights Co-op, are here. I'm going to just, Martin, why don't you take off, and we'll go from there.
Sure. We do a lot of work on all shapes of vessels in Port Townsend. I'm Martin Schiffer, Martin Mills. We use the work float a lot. There's a lot of vendors or businesses that use it quite a bit. And it really allows us to expand our jobs, complete our jobs. You know, a boat can't always be finished out of the water. I think it's just important for us to give our clients a reasonable value to work on their boat in the water. We also believe that by increasing the rates dramatically, you might reduce the use of it, which ultimately at the bottom line is going to probably be the same amount of money at the end of the day to the port. One thing that occurs to me is, unlike storage style of moorage, where you might use your boat every 6 months or 3 months or 3 days, there's no mandate for those people to spend money in Port Townsend. They can buy their fuel and on their way from somewhere else. They can buy their groceries, bring it from home. There's not a dollar needs to be spent in town other than to get on your boat, and whether it's commercial or recreational. When we're at the work float working on boats, Admiral Ship Supply makes money. Port of Townsend makes their money. The vendor, the shipyard, whether it's Shipwrights Co-op Haven, Armstrong Marine, Lisa Vizini in the rigging shop, canvas worker, those people are all making a little bit of money. People are buying gas in town. I mean, it's that the biggest dollar we can spend in this port is by working on boats in the port. Those dollars get filtered out, whether it's 2-1, 3-1, whatever number you want to come up with. So by kind of making it unattractive to use the work float, I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot. And that's just our belief. I don't think you're necessarily going to have to, I don't think you're going to make much extra money. If there's a scheduling issue, then I think we should approach it as a scheduling issue. And we're more than happy. We use it a lot, probably the biggest user, biggest contributor to that cost. But if it's a scheduling issue, let's come up with a scheduling solution, not a punishment for using the workflow. So that's kind of our stand, I think. I have something to add to that. But.
Yeah, I'm Tim Lee on the Shipwrights Co-op also, and like Martin was saying, a lot of times this is used, when I've used the workload, it's usually at the end of a big project. When somebody might come and spend $400,000 here and put a boat in the water and have that extra cost by the port, and sometimes it's been gouged by the port anyways at that point. So it's important for us to be able to finish it. And as far as the scheduling issue, there's been times when I've moved boats or somebody else, like Haven's had the workload and I've needed to load or unload something. I think the businesses who are using that also are pretty good about sharing it around. If that can happen in place, if somebody's needed to have a mast pole or be able to
And these are projects that might have already spent $9,000 in land storage. You know, if you take a 90-foot work boat and you spend $200,000 and you spend $9,000 on performance of storage, and then you take the work boat and you go, we're going to kind of get you here too. It's a hard thing to swallow for clients, and it's just gonna be harder for me to explain to them why we're doing it. And you know, there's a lot, especially on the workboat level, there's a lot of ports, especially in Alaska, I will say, that encourage working access to the water for working cranes. Homer Harbor has cranes that you actually just use your credit card and you get checked out and you can use the crane right on the dock. You know, working boat communities, which I gotta tell you is a huge part of what we've been making the last 5-10 years, is the workboat community is a huge, it seems really consistent, they spend money consistently. And I hate to, you know, there's one place you can use a crane in Fort Townsend to unload your gear, to load gear, to get fueled up in a large quantity, and now we're gonna charge more for that, and it seems like it's the wrong angle to take. I mean, if I was in charge, I would probably try to increase the amount of water to boat interaction, a land to boat interaction space, so that we can draw those boats. And I need to get my net off. I need to get, you know, we just don't have a lot of that in town. So now we're going to get things done. So, it's just hard to sell.
Yeah. What's dry storage per foot?
63 cents.
No, in the ship.
Oh,
in the shipyard. Yeah, the other day I was thinking about it in terms of a boat sitting in dry storage as opposed to a boat sitting at the work float. I mean, either way, you're working on the boat, not, you know, if I've got the Chilkat sitting out of the water, I'm not necessarily working on the bottom. I'm doing stuff like up on the foredeck and things like that. And so I was thinking about the rate in terms of dry storage versus work float storage. The other question I had is, so if you guys launch a big boat, as far as work float usage, do you move it over to the linear float as well? Like,
if we don't have a lot of work to do, we usually do.
Right.
It's an easier run. It's, you know, but if we have a lot of work to do, it really makes sense to use work float. And that's kind of what the intention. It's called a work float. Mm-hmm. It's accessible. It's got this fill response kit at the end of it. It was, I believe, designed as a work float. And so it also gets used for mortgage overflow, which is great, but I still think the core priority of it needs to be a work float for our working boat. So, you know, it's just one of those little things. We just got to talk about it. But it's I think we're, and at the end of the day, we're going to make more money off of it because it gets used half as much. I have concerns that, you know, maybe 5 years from now we'll go, we made exactly what we made last year as a port because nobody uses it anymore. And the people are encouraging guys to stand the lineal float, which is less money. So then we clog up all that mortgage while the work float's empty. And that doesn't make any sense to me either. So
yeah, plenty of boats get launched and go to the lineal dock.
Yeah, how big?
It's more expensive because, you know, we're walking for most of them go over there. And again, like I said earlier, sometimes you'll move a boat over there so that somebody who does have a crane specific job that needs that place or that access.
Or sometimes we'll move a boat for 5 minutes, 15-20 minutes. Lisa has a mast to take out. We shuffle around, we wrapped up. We've worked pretty well from our side of it to make that happen for their 2-hour job, you know. So, and the other issue is there's no water on the lineal dock side of it. There's no depth there because it's starting to slough in. And so you're trying to take a 90-foot fish boat that draws 12 feet of water, or the Adventurous, or any number of boats, and good luck keeping it there. It's drying out. And so it also gives us the opportunity to work on a boat up, or otherwise you got to go way up the lineal dock, which is really hard to sell to a client that I'm going to walk a quarter mile to get your boat because this is the issue. It is a great space because it's deeper too.
I think as we talked yesterday, the one up to 70 feet at 75 cents, up to 89 feet, 95 cents, and over 90, it's $1.15 per foot. Once we get to the point of redoing the C and D dock, since we moved the 75 ton pier, I think we need to be creative in the new design. We can kind of have, we have flexibility now without that other pier there, we can shift everything to that one side, opening up the, even though that's the commercial base, I consider that the commercial base down there, you know, more width and design additional work float capacity where the floats are really built to be work floats, you know, from a structural, physical standpoint.
Real cleats on them.
Right, with real cleats and big piles and, you know, they can take, you know, those heavy boats in the wind. And perhaps on the land side, do another pier where cranes can get out there a little bit and that sort of thing. That's the long-term solution. You know? So that's not going to happen in a day or two because that'll be the three-year permitting process.
I have yet to come up with a conflict that we couldn't come together as the maritime.
I think the scheduling.
Where we go.
I think we could do better at scheduling. You know, sometimes the boat will be on there, but it doesn't appear to be worked on, but sitting there. In the meantime, we got a recreational customer, mostly in the summer, recreational customer that we could put there, and they have to anchor off instead and that sort of thing. But I think we can be real flexible on that and move people around and get people that really need the work float on the work float when they need it and that sort of thing. As far as the rate, that's a commission decision. Not to throw it on your lap, but
one thing that, you know, we have talked about is the, it's just the PR perception, and and we're noticing the boatyard is emptier and there's a lot of potential revenue there. So that's a kind of more of a marketing issue, and we can probably do better at that. But particularly with the shipyard, it is doing well. And it's kind of a golden goose in that there aren't very many customers. You know, if you think about it, the number of boats that actually go through the shipyard, the number of people, owners, aren't that great compared to, doing 4,000 or 5,000 tourists in a business, that's hard to keep the level of public PR up, the customer service up, to where they're going to come back. But in the shipyard, that's not so hard because there's not that many people. And yet, if we don't do a good job with that customer service, you know, we've got Anchorage breathing, we've got Alaska breathing down our neck with you know, a lot of shipyard capacity coming online up there. So I think anything we can do to make it easier for the customer to want to come to Port Townsend is smart.
Yeah, you know, I would back that up. I would say that, you know, we're always trying to either entice boats that primarily live in Alaska and try and bring them down and probably say if we're closer to Seattle, we have, you know, great access to materials, but they come down. And they're, you know, when I came to town, people thought it was great. They would come from Alaska and park a boat here. They'd spend the whole winter having the boat rebuilt. They'd rent a house. They would move down here and they would say it's cheaper than Alaska. It's not like that anymore. So they come down from Alaska. They are staying in hotels, putting crew up, putting workers up. So you're trying to, you got to stay competitive to where they have the option to stay in Alaska. They're going to stay in Alaska now. And getting stuff up there, the materials is much easier. And then the other market that we compete with is Seattle. It's kind of the same thing. It's like if we get to where it's as expensive to have your boat worked on here as it is in Seattle, we're going to stop being able to entice those clients away because, again, they can leave their house, they can drive out to the yard, they can be there. So we've got to kind of play that balance. We have the talent here, we have the materials here, but we still have to be able to entice them away from those other markets who are, you know, watching what we're doing.
It's a value-based, there's some little things that we don't have to spend money to do. You know, I've talked about a lot. I talked about, you know, not on a tangent, but the having my experiences, having my big commercial boats in the places that I go in Alaska, and once stick in your mind that treats you really well when you get there. You know, you're tired, you've been driving for 3 days, and they don't come down and camera on you right away. It's a, what I like to say is it's innocent until proven guilty attitude is what we need to lead with. What we lead with, unfortunately, of course, sometimes is just like, you're going to try and screw us, so we're going to come down and kind of get in your face right off the bat. And I really think it's the wrong approach to take. There's some other ways that we can improve that. You know, talking to IP a little bit, you know, it being able to have as somebody that spends $300,000 here and gives $10,000 just to the port for storage, when they launch their boat and 2 hours later they have somebody at the dock going, who are you, what are you doing, you owe us money, you know, just a communication on the way by the yard office, say, what boats we got launching today, can I go down there and say, man, your boat looks great, you've been out of the water for a while, when you get a chance, come up and get us, let's settle up on moorings, or are you going to do this through the Shipwrights Club, or just the, it's just a tone, and I've seen it, and it's a big issue, and but there's got to be some way to come to a solution. It's not going to cost us a dime to have a better PR when boats show up in this town. And you know, there's some other little ideas, the parking pass for businesses. I'm willing to sign something that says, if our clients don't pay you, we will. But you know, I give them a pass and they put it in their window and the mortgage office comes down and says, oh, Shipwrights Club's working on this boat. Great. I'll call them, deal with that. I don't have to put a tag on their boat. I don't have to make a big deal. It's not a huge thing, but for some reason it really puts people's hackles up. When they come to a town and they go, I feel like I'm a criminal. Before I even get off my boat, I'm being treated like somebody that's not going to pay their bills. And so I think it's a tone we need to change. And it's been coming, it's, you know, it's going to be a big change, but let's work on it. So that's tangential a little bit to the workflow, but it's all part of the thing. How can we create a value and an experience that makes people say, Port Townsend is the greatest place to work on your boat? And it's not, we don't have to change much. We've got the skill, like, we've got a great facility, great skill, great supplies. We've got a great town to feed them and make them feel welcome when they get here. We just got to keep it up and kind of remember that we're a service industry, and that's our job. And if you can't do service, then you might need a different job. And so, and then there was the other topic of, do you want me to reach the other thing, Shipwrights Co-op. We'd like to clarify the 3% surcharge on the heavy haul out. I don't know the status of the note on that. I know it was, from what my knowledge is that 3% surcharge was designed to pay for the heavy haul out and its facilities. Is that note paid for? Do we need to re-approach informing the tenants that they're going to continue to pay it? We're going to name it, whatever we need to do, but if it's done, get paid for, let's stop and go, hey, do we still need this? If we still need it, we kind of should be able to go to the town or the port and say, we still really need this 3%. Can we come up with another way to raise this money? We'd like to be in the loop on that instead of just rolling it from a debt to, let's just keep paying it. It's like if I was done renting a house and I just kept getting a bill in the mail, even though that wasn't the agreement. And I think we would like to encourage an audit of the 3% over the last few years, because it's been kind of a honor system set up, and it's worked well, and we've paid every bit that we've owed. And for our example, 2015, we paid $34,000 in 3% surcharges. 2014, $22,000. 2013, $37,000. We've done that because we know the clients, if they're in your yard, might be hard to track down. It's the honor system. We'd like to know who's paying it, because we're paying plenty of it. And if other tenants in the Port of Port Townsend are saying, well, you just deal with the boat owner, or just we'll just kick this down the street, we'd like to know where that money, where ours has gone, and whether everyone's paying their part, because it'd be nice to know that we're not the only ones doing the right thing. So. And it hasn't been enforced, it hasn't been always coming and looking at our books at the end of the year, that's fine, but we should, at least, we'd like to know where we stand in that, and how much was made on 3% last year, and if our $34,000 was 80% of it, or 20% of it, or 5% of it. And so we'd like to get some public knowledge on it. You know, we'd like to see where we stand that way. And then, along with that, is it still active, the 3%? What are we going to use that money for? And we should maybe have a voice in that. Those are our topics today.
Can you want me to paraphrase a little bit of what we talked about?
Sure.
Yeah. So it is an honor system. There are a lot of exemptions that come in that Jim and I were talking about, it's not a very clean system. It was done long before anybody
part of the
was here.
Condition of getting the loan from the state community economic revitalization board loan.
Right.
And it's still being, the loan is still active. Okay. Still paying on the loan.
It is done this year. The loan is paid off this year. So then the question is, okay, so we lose that revenue stream. We got to figure out how to replace that revenue stream in the budget. But we can, you know, as far as auditing of who's paying, who's not paying, yeah, we can figure that out. Right.
You said there's a bunch of exemptions.
Well, like if a boat
doing your own work as yeah, the owner, we don't.
Yeah, if the Navy comes in and tents off a big tug and they're doing all their own work, they're not paying the 3%. So it was set more up, as I understand it, with the shipyards that are here.
There's like 10 or 12 marine trades that signed on to the agreement.
Right.
Well, I'd be curious. Like, we've never really complained about it.
No.
We pay it. We make sure we get it.
Right.
We pay it, comes out of our pocket. And we're not complaining about that and help with this facility that's been wonderful for our business. But at the same time, it'd be nice to know whether we're carrying it or if everyone's carrying it equally. Because
right,
there's lots of people that benefited from this this heavy haul out, and it'd be nice to at least know whether that's been equally shared or if it's the honor system is working.
Well, and it's called out in the profit and loss, right? As a line item, that tax, that 3% tax. So you can certainly look at what the annual income has been on that line item and then subtract out what you guys have been putting in.
Sure.
To see what else, to see who's been putting in what.
Sense.
Right.
You know, the only other way to do it is to look at, you know, one thing that's unique is we run a lot of our haul ops through our business too. We kind of encapsulated it as we're going to help recharge the haul, but mm-hmm, a lot of the businesses seem a little more anonymous about the boats in front of my shop. But they're going to take care of all that billing. So how does that all filter down? But we can, mm-hmm, we have pretty good sense of who worked on what. But you know, I don't even want to create a witch hunt for this. We just want to find out whether it's working for everybody. And
yep,
just some rough numbers would get us a start. If we
so
see
we're this is the 2016 budget I just pulled up here. We're predicting since the 81,000 and 3% revenue for this year. Last year we ended up with 75,000.
So we
2014 we had 94,000.
A little under half of that.
Yeah.
So,
and it's changed a little. You know, when Towns of Bay was in their full glory, they were paying a lot.
Sure.
But you know, they goes, you know.
But it, you know, then we haul half the boats.
Yeah.
That's a question.
There you go. Right there. Yeah.
I guess that's research for us to do, but it seemed like it's fairly loose.
And we very purposely have left it loose over the years. You know, back to the customer service aspect, we could be real draconian and demand all your invoices and receipts and almost be like the state auditor looking over every marine trade shoulder as they do these projects. And we've never wanted to do that. So it is on the honor system. And I'm sure some people are a lot more honest than others out there.
There might not be a lot to be done about it, but yeah, there's the two topics of what, how's this going to continue? Obviously, we've spent the money. It's you know, it is what it is, but and I think we encourage that we don't create a draconian system for it, but it's also a curiosity of ours on a public entity to see who's. Right. And that also affects, this all affects the workflow. So when we have the workflow, if we pay our 3%, I feel like we're contributing to the port in so many ways. Can we remember that at the end of the day? If it's all, it all takes care of everything. We're just a big system, you know. So, and those clients are paying that 3% one way or the other. It's coming out of somebody's pocket, and so.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, we've talked about it before. I know I've mentioned it during this last budget cycle that once the loan is paid off, that's a decision you're going to have to make. Do we continue it? Do we rename it? Because at the same time, we're paying off that debt, that's fine. But during these same years, our environmental costs have skyrocketed and other costs have gone up. So the total cost of operating the yard versus what revenue we're gaining, you know, you're gonna have to take a hard look at that and balance it. And whether you continue with this, call it a different name, start something else, increase somewhere else, you know, it's all going to be looked at.
Raise the workload cost.
There you go.
Well, that's part of our long-term planning too, though, that we have to consider what's, you know, nothing lasts forever. That right. Machine's going to need more maintenance, repairs, so on. There's going to be future investments that we have to consider. Yeah. You know, so it's not just done, paid off. It's not going to sit there and last forever. It's like the replacement of the docks and so on. So that's something we've got to consider.
The slide is sticky, even now, the moving the pulleys.
Well, it's a
hard my assessment this summer of, you know, I don't know, you guys, you know, we don't need to hire somebody to come in and do an assessment, but the haul-out fees, we never hear a complaint. They're really reasonable. They're probably as cheap as anywhere in Tucson or Alaska, the actual lift itself. The only complaints I ever hear is actually the storage and things like the workflow, things like that. The lift itself, I actually think it has some room for an increase because having owning a 9-foot boat that needs a lift that size, I've looked around and it's a really good value right now. And I think we should keep it a good value, but at the same time, maybe that's a place to find that those maintenance costs to cover 3%. It'll be interesting to do some checking in because in my experience, that's the best value going for a heavy boat. Is the lift itself pretty affordable? So just a little something for you guys to hear from somebody that's checked into it.
It'd be interesting to see that 3% go away, but I don't know of any tax that was ever started that said, well, we're going to use this to pay for that, and then when it's paid for, they probably say, okay, we're done with it, it's gone. Rather than saying, no, well, we've kind of grown used to that 3%, how are we going to keep it going?
Well, it'll go away. We'll just find something.
Right. It's nice to not do that because the idea was that 3% was supposed to pay for the construction of it. Now we're talking about, well, now we need that 3%.
There's certainly been a lot of examples out of Olympia doing that where.
Well, I'm sure everyone will get kept in the loop too.
Oh, yeah.
That's the good part. But so those are our main, topics. And we can go on and on about. Going on about PR and how to make the port more attractive to Alaska and to the work fleet and the large yacht fleet. And I mean, everyone has similar opinions, and so, but you know, we're not going to solve any of that. But those are the kind of the things that we are trying to solve so that our clients, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to selling to our clients, keep them coming, keep them happy. How are we going to do that? And this all has to do with that. So we. Keep 40 jobs in the firm.
And those kind of big bills at the end of the project do have a bigger impact than the big bill at the front.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I said a big bill or something like added on at the end, like going to the workflow and having that price has been increased quite a bit when they've been here before. And those, the dollars spent at the end of a project have more negative impact on a client than at the beginning of it.
Especially when they start to feel.
Yeah, because that's what they're realizing. No, I came here thinking I was going to spend $50,000 and $250,000 into it. You know, the bottom of my belt, and then you go in there, oh, they're going to gouge me again. So if you're looking for revenue, I would say, like Ryan said, look at maybe the hoist cost where they pay at the front end rather than hitting on the back end of the project.
You could raise the hoist by $150 and give them a free night of warranty, and they think you were getting a great deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an illusion of value. You know, we're going to give you this for free. And it's an illusion of value. And I've had several clients now say, it'd be nice if when I launched my boat at 3 o'clock, I just got that night to kind of soak up, settle in, nobody down here screaming at me about mortgage, and then the next day we deal with it. Or, you know, and there's a fairly affordable way to go, this is great. We're the Port of Port Townsend. You know, you've done a great project here. You stayed for a month, we're going to give you that free that first night to get back in the water. Be great. And it would also encourage them to leave because when they're done, because they'd be like, oh, we get this night, let's get our act together, let's get our groceries up, we'll get out. So they're going to go spend $700 in Safeway and put groceries on their boat. They're going to do that, they're going to drive away. So there's just a lot of, I think there's a huge economic drive for some of these projects. And you see who's busy here and who's spending the money, and I just want to encourage that to continue.
Well, like Tim, you said, you know, for the 40 jobs you guys have, but add up you know, the two saners that are getting built down there, and Haven, and what Corey's doing, and what Dan's doing.
Crazy whale watch people.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a lot, I mean, how many people are employed at that end of the yard? Just,
I mean, there's just a lot of drive. Employed is one thing. I just like to always remember the fall off on decent-sized projects, and whether it's a workboat or a yacht. One thing that's unique about workboats is that they bring their own crew to work on it, which seems like a pain to us. It often is. But when they're eating out every night, they're at Safeway buying toothpaste and groceries, and they're down at the bar, and they're renting a car, and they're buying fuel. The economic fall off from those big crude workboats, four or five. You go to the Westward, we're not involved in it. They've got five people working on it. They all got to eat. They all got to buy a new t-shirt or a set of work pants out at the store. They need to go, you know, they need to go to the eye doctor. They got all that. They're here for 3 months. Their life has moved here. They're going to spend at least as much as they're spending there just in our community. Safeway, they provision up. They might buy fuel in town. It's huge. It's a huge fall off. And we have a 90-foot yacht in our boat, in our yard right now. It's going to spend a lot of money when the ship rates go. But they disappeared. They drove away. Fix my boat. I'm going back. I trust you. Great. Great for us. Their fall off is negligible. They're going to come and eat dinner a couple times in town. And they're going to maybe fuel up before they leave to go back. But the big crude workboats are spending huge dollars here every day. And so they're filling our jails. Perfect. They contribute in so many ways.
You keep Larry out in the middle of the night, coming down there with the sheriff.
Yeah. I've been here many a night at midnight with some of your customers.
Exactly.
And the sheriff.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you look at the hardware store, coast to coast, and Henry Hardware. It was downtown, right? Mm-hmm. What's the smartest thing they did? They moved right across the boulevard.
I would really encourage, you know, Martin, you and I talk all the time, and I would really encourage you guys to hook up with, like, Julia and Corey and Dan and stuff. I mean, it would be interesting for you at some point. I know you guys are all really busy and you're flat out, but it would be interesting for you to talk about customer service and then relate that back to us so there's an open line of communication. So, you know, you're saying, well, my customers are leaving because of X, Y, and Z, or my customers are really happy because of A, B, C. And that way, you see what I'm saying?
Well, it's super important, and I would be happy to do that. But I think we don't have a problem. We talk to
customers
that we have relationship with.
And even better, it really.
Dan Wiggins and I have a great relationship. We have a great relationship with Dan. He's doing a ton of work right now.
There's one condition, though, on that. There's been over the years a couple of, quite a number of sessions where I've gone down to Julia's place and actually hugged their customer. I don't necessarily want to do that with any of yours.
Yeah, you don't want to. Yeah. But yeah, I'm happy to do that. I think on a public relations level that we could create a very casual conversation about how can we improve this without costing it. It doesn't like it cost the time. It's just about changing attitudes and having the right staff to enforce those attitudes. Yeah. And like I said, this is a sales job. This is a public relations job. Everything from here to there, whether it's my job working on a boat, it's about sales and public relations. And if we can't do that, then this isn't your job.
Well, another benefit of that too is it's kind of a backdoor market survey, because you're through your customers, you know, whether it's the workboats in Alaska or the guy with the yacht, I mean, they visit yards all over the world. So, you know, you feeding back to us on what your customers are saying on how we compare to what everybody else is doing is a cheap way of finding information.
And it's a more accurate way. You can send out paper surveys all you want, but really it's the chatter,
right. The
radio chatter is really what tells you what the truth is.
Right.
And what we want is the radio chatter in the fishing grounds or wherever, or at the yacht club meeting, you need that casual chatter to say, that was the greatest boatyard I ever went to. Yeah. And if we keep that up, then this is going to stay busy, we're all going to have jobs, town's going to benefit from us being here, but it's one of the really hard things to make tangible, and we're more than happy to do that, but whether you want us to lead the charge on that, or the commissioners maybe try and put together that and have a workshop or something. I know it's hard with three commissioners in a room, two commissioners, one commissioner, but it also, I feel like it could be something for you guys to inspire, not just us to inspire on our own, because it affects the court in a gigantic way. And you're right, we're busy, and it's hard. I sit down with anybody in this court and have a talk about it, and we're going to have a great talk and have a great visit about it.
So. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for coming in.
I got to say, I've benefited from people coming into town from Alaska and so on, staying with their crew for 3 or 4 months. That certified PTEC, I think three of them, I think four, three I know with for sure, certifications in diving as well as in sound equipment, things like that they're using for obvious reasons when they're out there in the field and working.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I don't think anybody argues that it is, and it's hard to make tangible, but it's going to hurt if it goes away. The more it goes away, the more it's going to hurt. So. And we have, I got to tell you, having spent a lot of time in Alaska on a work boat, is we still have a really great facility. And Alaskans still want to come here. It's still, and mainly it's because of the skilled workforce. And so, and the weather's better, and the materials are better, and some of them just want to get out of the state. But 3/4 of the, I think, probably Alaska fleet doesn't, the boats don't stay in Alaska. And so we're still in a good spot, but there is some barking at the door. Wrangell, Sitka's not talking about putting in a big lift. Kodiak has a big lift. Seward's got a decent big lift. Homer's talking about now they've got great space to put a big lift. There's pressure, so we got to, just like in the boatyard, we got to be the best boatyard we can be so that we can retain our clients. The port's going to be the best port it can be to retain value for its clients. And it's just basic economics. We don't have to be the biggest, we just have to be the best. And that's what's important. And whatever you guys can do on all this stuff, I think we can always have more conversations about that.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thanks for the talk.
Carol, did you have something you want to say?
Oh, yes. Well, at our last meeting, I expressed concern, and that's a degree of frustration about failures, discharge monitoring reports that we're required to submit to the DOE. I would like to know where we stand now and how does the DOE feel about us now that we've failed the test at least 6 times, and that does require a certain response from us, and is that response, which I believe is an engineering report, in process now?
You guys want
to? No, the engineering report was done a long time ago. We surpassed that point more than a year ago. And so DOE's been up, they checked, November. They came up and visited the site and they all took them all around and they were satisfied that we're working as best we can at it. Tomorrow I've got a sit down with Al and to talk about the whole process, and we did a change in protocol of testing, which I have some concern about, but we're doing everything we can do and what's expected of us by DOE at this point.
So we have submitted the engineer's report.
You want a copy of it?
It's on the website.
It's on the website. The engineer's report.
But nothing beyond October. I'm sorry, I haven't found it there. What is the essence of our solution that we're going to put into effect to meet the stormwater standards?
Well, it's a whole.
What's the gist?
It's a more complicated, just an easy 5-minute response here. The best thing would be to come on in and sit down with, I'll be happy to sit down with you and Al can be there. We can walk you through the engineer report if you want.
I see. And you say that was completed over a year ago.
Yeah.
But we're required to submit these tests
whenever it rains sufficiently enough to cause the system to flow. We have to take a sample and take it to the lab and submit that. Now, there's a lot of months living in the rain shadow here and everything else where you get multiple months where there's no samples taken because there's not enough rain.
Okay, well, according to our permit, we're required, at the very least, to submit these reports.
Yeah, we do.
October, November, January, April, May.
Right, and we submit all those reports.
So in the year since we submitted the engineering report that you're talking about, we've continued to fail these tests. How does the DOE feel about this now?
The same as they feel about all the yards, like every one of them is failed.
Are we on par with all the other yards?
We're better than a lot of them. We're essentially on par with all of them, yeah.
There's been a lot of talk about how this boatyard is perceived. Consider what it would do for us if we were not only competitively priced, and in an agreeable location, but we're actually leading as far as complying with the very stringent standards. I think that could be a really good thing for us. If people said, not only is it a good place to go and work on the boat, but they are capable, environmentally aware.
Thank you, Carol.
It could be a really good boatyard if it became known that they were leading the pack, so to speak, in this matter.
Appreciate your comments. All right. Well, we've completed our items. I think we'll agenda and meet again at 1 o'clock for our regular session.